Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Stone Payton, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio. And Stone, we got a busy day today.
Hey, this is going to be a lot of fun. In a little while, later in the program, we are going to get a chance to share with our listeners about a whole new media property.
That's right.
Being launched. But first up on Atlanta Business Radio this morning, it is my distinct pleasure to welcome to the broadcast CEO and co-founder of Thrive, Mr. Jonathan Dalton. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. How are you?
We are doing well. Before we get too far into things, John, can you share a little bit about Thrive? How are you serving folks?
Yeah, so Thrive is a product development and innovation strategy firm here in Atlanta. So what we do is help ambitious business leaders build iconic brands through design.
And then, so are you with the creation of the product or service, or is it just the strategy around it?
We do all three of those. So we can create brand new products all the way from an upfront insight that we have, which comes through research. Mm-hmm. All the way through to designing that product. So we sketch it on a napkin all the way through to production and putting that product on shelf. And we also do a lot of customer experience work as well, so around services.
So are you doing your own stuff, or it's always a company is hiring you?
So far, it's always companies who are hiring us. So we typically work with Fortune 500 organizations around the world.
And then so they come to you and they're like, hey, we want to be in this space. Do you have any ideas, or like, what's the relationship? How does that work?
It can be. That's one way that companies come to us. They can say, look, we'd like to move into this market. We don't know how to enter. Can you help us how to find out? So our social scientists and anthropologists that we have on staff go out there into the big wide world. They go where life is lived. They observe people in their homes, in their workplaces, to understand, you know, what their unmet needs are, what kind of pain points they have around a product or service. And then we crunch that data. We come back with a whole range of insights that we then make actionable for product development. And at the end of that, we develop a brand new product or service that
it
is...
It could be brand new.
It could be brand new.
That category may not even exist yet.
It could not exist yet, yeah. And that's one way we work. The other way we work, an organization may come to us with an existing product that needs improving, and we use a very similar process on that. So it's a spread, you know, it's a whole continuum around that type of service, essentially.
So how did you get started? What was the catalyst for this?
Like all good entrepreneurs, sometimes, you know, we all get laid off from our previous jobs and we think, now what? Yeah, so I used to be the design director at Philips Electronics here in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. And they exited the consumer electronics market here in North America, which meant that several of the studios were closed down. Unfortunately, one of ours was. So me and my business partner, Trent Cahoot, who also worked at
Philips. So you were working together, you're both laid off, you're like, hey, let's see if we can
help
some
people. Let's give this a go. Yeah, we got laid off, we got the golden parachute, and sometimes timing is everything. So I was like, okay, so it's now or never, and 9 years later, we're still here. So
must be doing something right. Now, what was that transition like working for a big company when you're John at Philips? That call probably gets returned pretty easily. But when you're John at Thrive and they don't know what Thrive is, what was that like?
Very different. Fortunately, I'd worked at other agencies and consultancies, so I was very aware of how to develop business.
Right.
I've been in that position before, which was good because I've worked corporate, consultant. I've done both over my career. So I had a sense of where we were going, what we needed to do. But yeah, it's very different. You know, it's slow going. You have to build your reputation piece by piece.
Right.
And
One project at a time.
And you're only as good as your last project. Right. So it's very simple.
It really is, isn't it?
Work hard. Do good work. You know, everything. Be kind to people, and guess what? They come back for more. It's a pretty simple combination.
Now, was that your past relationships helped you get kind of the first project that you had to show off to others?
Yeah, it came through a friend of Trent's, actually. He works at an organization here in
Atlanta.
I don't know.
You should take all the credit. You're the CEO.
Yeah, sure. Well, you know.
He's a friend of yours, too.
Yeah. I didn't know him, so technically, I guess that qualifies. Yeah, he gave us our first project. We then pushed out on our own. You know, we came up with the name Thrive. We put a small website up with our past experiences and projects we'd done and products and things. And then the big surprise actually was, and we changed our positions on LinkedIn to Thrive, and the phone started to ring. People got back in touch, and people from years in my past, like,
wow,
people at companies I'd worked with 15 years earlier got in touch. I've got a project for you, I can help you out. So we had a lot of generous people who reached out.
Were you putting out like thought leadership around?
Not at that time.
It was just like, hey, I exist, and that was enough. The power of your brand, the John.
It did for the first 2 years.
John Dalton brand.
Yeah, and it changes. So I mean, it's the same thing. Like, always be kind, always be good to people.
Right.
You know, be kind, be useful, and that's for most people. That, you know, means you are a trusted person, and
right.
Somewhere at the back of their brains, they remember.
So now, a lot of what you do, a lot of innovative things, and then you're working with these kind of large corporate entities where they talk about innovation a lot, but in a big bureaucracy, it's hard, isn't it, to be really truly innovative?
It is. I mean, every organization has their own corporate gravity, as we call it.
Yeah.
And there's a strong status quo, and people talk a real big game, and when it often right. comes down to it, they don't follow through.
Do you find that to be so? Or because like that's what you hear these big companies like, we want to be the most innovative thing. We want to be the disruptor. We're not going to be disrupted.
Yeah.
And then everyone in the organization is afraid of losing their jobs. So they don't want to take any risks. And that you have to like touch the edges, right? To innovate, you can't.
Yeah, I think one of the big problems with innovation is that innovation is not a quick thing. You know, it's a long-term play. And corporate America is driven by quarter by quarter.
Quarterly earnings.
You've got to show quarterly earnings. And innovation can take 5 years sometimes to get a new product out.
So I have a question about innovation. How do you, if you're successful in building a culture where ideas are surfaced,
mm-hmm.
and you get a lot of good ideas, and I know good is a subjective term, and you get people sharing this stuff, and it doesn't get implemented for whatever reason, how do you keep them fired up about continuing to share ideas where they don't get fatigued and say, you know, I keep coming up with all these ideas and it never gets implemented? How do you keep them fired up to do that?
Yeah, ideas that don't get implemented are probably not good ideas, or they're not the relevant idea.
But you don't want to say it to me, or do you? Maybe you do. If I'm that employee, you still want me to keep trying, though, right? You want me to come back next?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we go into organizations and we say, look, that didn't work. You know, let's tear that apart a little bit and try and understand why. And most ideas that don't get implemented is because at some point down the line, any organization is going to test if that idea is going to resonate with enough people to
make, can you commercialize it?
Yeah, right. Does it get a green light? Does it get the funding? All those types of things. And often it doesn't, because they'll go out, they'll test these things quantitatively with a pretty big sample with consumers, and what comes back is that, you know, no, that this isn't what people want. And that's the biggest problem with innovation that we see. When people think of innovation, they build an office, they put post-it notes in it, they get some black bean bags, some nice tables, some whiteboards and some markers, and like, hey, look, we can be innovative. And what they forget is that innovation is about understanding people first. And that is the biggest component we see missing in most organizations. You have to take a human-centered approach.
Is there though, a skill set as well, and I don't know, even so much as methodology or structure or rigor or discipline to, if you're a professional innovator-type person and you're in this, you must subscribe to some sort of process or something that you put the amateur, like Lee and I, through if we want to try to be more innovative about expanding our network?
Yeah. The best way to learn to be innovative is to learn by doing. So we're very collaborative with our clients. our studio is set up as a very collaborative space we bring our clients into. Each client gets their own project room where they can come in and immerse themselves.
Their own beanbag chair.
We don't. There's not one beanbag chair in our office, actually. I'm trying to think.
But you know how
we do not have a beanbag chair. We do have lots of post-it notes, though, and things like that, but no beanbags so far.
But, you know, we pride ourselves on, and of course, you're particularly good at it, Lee, of conducting a good interview and drawing people out and getting them to share their story. I suspect, my intuition is that your staff are really good at asking the right kinds of questions.
Absolutely.
And pulling it out of us, right?
Yeah, it's all about context. So you probably all heard of focus groups. They're great further down the innovation process. They're very good at helping you validate that you have a good idea or value proposition, or down selecting from a handful to a single one. What they're not good is it generating the criteria to ideate around. And that's when you go into people's homes, you know, where people work and play, to understand them in context. You know, you need to understand what their daily lives are, what their struggles are, what their pain points are. And that's where insights come from.
You're not going to jump the track by asking a focus group. If Henry Ford would have asked a focus group what they wanted, they'd have set a faster horse.
Famous quote. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Very famous quote. Yeah.
But so you guys help us get out of our own head, jump the track.
We never ask people what they want.
Ah, interesting.
That's not an insight. You know, I want a red Ferrari. I'm not going to get one. You know, people have whims that they ask for. You've really got to observe, use a lot of indirect questioning. You got to understand where they're coming from, you know, what kind of social circles they're in, how they think from a psychological point of view. All these things give you a very rich context of who they are and what they need. And it's very rare that they'll just tell you, and that's an insight. You know, you have to build an insight.
So right? Now you're using insight instead of idea.
Yeah.
That's not accidental.
No, ideas start with insight. I think that's a big thing. That's the big myth around innovation. And I think the common myth is that you have this lone genius in a room who comes up with an idea. He gets struck by lightning and he rolls it out.
The apple falls on his head.
And he's like, oh, great. I'll make an iMac, you know, because we hear about Steve Jobs all the time. And I think the guy was an incredible designer, but he also has a massive team of people behind him, and they do research, even though he said they don't, they do. But they don't ask people what they want. You know, they'll observe, they'll understand, and things like that. So
when you're working with a large entity and you're explaining this process, is that resonating with them, or they want something a little
It is often
quicker?
A lot of organizations come to us and says, we've got lots of ideas. And that's great. I mean, ideas are pretty common. You can sit two people in a room.
Right.
They can ideate all day and they can come up with 100 ideas.
Right.
But that's ideas in a vacuum. That they aren't in a context that may not be relevant to the people that company is trying to serve. So, you know, it's far more better to have a good insight.
Like, what's an example of an insight you've seen recently?
We could try it right now. So it starts off, so if you want to create a good insight, it starts off with context. So the context is here, we're in a studio, okay? And then you're probably going to have a frustration about the studio, so.
Only one? Yes, no, you're, no, absolutely,
so,
of course.
So, you know, what's your biggest frustration with this studio?
Not sharing enough stories with enough people fast enough. If I used a word, I would say speed, but it's more in depth than that. But I just don't feel like we're doing a really good thing. Just I feel like we're in second gear.
Okay, so kind of the insight statement might be like, in our production, I'm frustrated that we can't get our programs out quick enough to a broad enough audience. And then the kind of final part of an insight statement might be, I wish. So what's the ideal state?
I wish that rather than 9 studios doing what we're doing this morning, 900 were doing what we're doing this morning, and that we all continue to capitalize on all the efficiencies of scale and all that come with that kind of thing.
So it might be, I wish we had a way of scaling more efficiently.
Yes.
So then I'll turn that around as a statement. How might we scale our studios more efficiently so we can get our message into the market faster? And then I can get a team of thrivers, as we call them, and we could ideate around that statement. And then we come up with several ideas. We'd then take them back to the end, you know, customer or client, and, you know, find out which one of those ideas is resonating, is easy to implement, and things like that. So that's typically how it rolls out. So with a strong insight, that gives your ideation direction. Otherwise, you just hear ideating.
As opposed to me just walking in one morning and saying, hey, Lee, we need to get on one more platform. That's right. An idea, that, right?
That's not, that's a tactic.
That doesn't have the context that you just helped us walk through.
Yeah. You can't build an expansive, robust strategy behind that either. And that's what you want. Yeah, it's going to be scalable, repeatable over time.
Now, in your work, because of your background at Philips, do you work a lot in kind of technology companies? Is that a sweet spot for you? Are you working in like some of Internet of Things in that area?
We do a little bit of everything. We tend to work in three big verticals. Healthcare is one. We do a lot of work in that. There's so much wrong with healthcare. It's such a complex just industry. You know, there's so many things that need fixing. It's a great design problem. And there's thousands of them.
That's good job security.
So we do a lot of work in that area, and that's probably 50% of our business is right there. We do a lot of work in the food and beverage vertical as well. So Coca-Cola, Chick-fil-A, McDonald's.
Like in terms of coming up with new flavors or brands or their devices? Or
not flavors and brands. It tends to be more devices or experiences. You know, so, you know, what's the restaurant experience of the future? Mm-hmm. Understanding their existing pain points in a restaurant, things like that. So we do a lot of work in that space. And the third vertical is more consumer goods. So it could be everything from a coffee maker to a Bluetooth speaker. We work for a whole range of companies in that space as well.
Now, are you doing any work around the smart home?
We do. We do. We've done quite a bit of work in the smart home recently.
So how's the homes? Are they much smarter than they were?
Yeah. That's kind of a point of view. We don't consider them to be that smart right now.
we're like toddlers at the homes.
We are. We're still walking around in diapers right now in terms of smart home development.
Of what it could be.
Yeah. I mean, what the kind of parallel that we draw here is a person. You know, what makes a smart person, right? You know, they can think through a problem. They're empathetic. You know, they understand what's going on. They can anticipate things like that. And to me, that's smart. Whereas if you look at a smart home right now, we have a lot of devices in the home. They aren't they may be connected. They can turn something on for you. It's automated, but it's not smart. It's not really anticipating your needs on a daily basis or an hourly basis.
Is that a technology problem, or is there enough technology to do that now and we're just not either comfortable with it or we haven't executed on it yet?
There is the technology to do that. So where we like to see this going, I think, and where it will end up is that the home will be more empathetic to the people in it. And that's going to require a lot of technology that is built into the fabric of the home. So, for example, I think the automobile will get there before the home will, because that's a very controlled environment.
And smaller.
Smaller, your hands on the wheel, you're in a stable position. You know,
it's doing the same thing for most people 90% of the time.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And the key to this is to sense people's behavior. And in an automobile, you're on a wheel, you got an interaction point there, you're sat down, they can scan your eyes and things like that. So Hyundai had a project a couple of years ago that they did, and they rolled it out at the Consumer Electronics Show in Vegas. And that car, through a camera and sensors on the wheel, could sense if someone was actually falling asleep. Mm-hmm. And then because of that, its intelligence, it could then blow cold air at the person to keep them awake. It could change the color on the dashboard from blue to red.
Raise the volume of the radio.
Raise the volume, all these kind of things. So if you take that as a very controlled environment and then you kind of take that across the home, you know, that car's got a level of empathy for that user. A home would need a lot of sensors in the walls, in the fabric.
And in all the devices.
And in all the devices. It's all got to be connected. The smart home right now is like the Wild West of the electronics industry. There's a lot of different protocols out there, platforms and things like that. It's not really been standardized in any way so far.
And that's what's going to have to happen in order for it to really scale?
I think there need to be some standardization.
Right.
It could be one route. The other route is all these big companies all kind of fight each other to get the platform. So obviously right. you got Google and Amazon right now.
Right, and then now I got to buy five different devices if I want five different services. And
exactly. So even though I'm very enthusiastic mm-hmm. about what the smart home can be, I have very few devices in my house that are smart right now. Well, right. smart in inverted commas, because I don't think the platforms have been resolved yet.
Right.
So you don't want to jump on to one for that in 6 months' time to be...
Right. And then it's
redundant. Yeah. And that happens all the time right now. So there'll be a great startup company. We'll create a brand new hub.
And you're like, wow, this does this one thing. And you're like, that's fantastic.
You buy that and then Amazon purchases them, retires the product to take them out the market. And you're there with all your stuff at home that you can't expand upon. So it's very much in its infancy and it's got a long way to go. But I think the potential is great. I mean, a home should enrich the lives of the people in
right.
it. And this is one way a home can do that.
Right. And it's like you say, it has to be empathetic. Like if my refrigerator knew that mm-hmm. I'm out of butter
yeah.
and then mm-hmm. added butter to my list on my phone of,
yeah.
you know, and when I go to Publix, the list appears and goes, remember, you need butter.
Right.
Like and that should all be doable to me. Like that's not a bridge too far.
That's already out there. So people like LG and Samsung do have that technology. I think where I'm looking is that a home can sense your emotions more. So I come in, I've had a bad day at work, I'm tired, my shoulders are slouched and down, I've got bags under my eyes, and my home knows that, and it runs a real nice hot bath
wow.
or something. I mean, that's where, I mean, and you can do that with all the sensing technology we have now. It's just a matter of cost and scale.
Right.
So I think over time we will get there. But to me, emotional sensing is really where it gets to be really smart.
And that's next level. We're not there yet.
No one's there yet. If you go on the Thrive blog, we have a few blogs on this. We identified four different archetypes that are out there right now. The top one was an empathizer, and we couldn't find any product out there that did that yet. So that's white space.
Right.
So, and that's where Thrive helps. It's right. like an organization, help us be that company. And that's what we do.
So how does the whole sales and marketing thing work for a company like yours? Does the phone just ring? Are you out there? You got somebody out there sort of kicking the bushes a little bit? Or how's that work?
Yeah, it's a few different things. A lot of it, I mean, the design industry, and especially the product development industry, is a pretty small industry. I mean, there's probably...
Oh yeah,
2,000 to 5,000 practicing professionals in a consultant capacity, probably here in North America. So that's pretty small.
Oh yeah, relatively, that's tiny, right?
Yeah.
Compared
so
to most domains?
If you're very good at what you do and you are reliable and consistent, word gets around. So word of mouth, like any business, is huge. We still do quite a lot of push. So despite what people say, cold calling is not dead. You can have warm cold calling, which is kind of what we do, but you know, so we still do quite a lot of push. And over the past 2 or 3 years, what we've done is really upped our thought leadership. So if you go on thrivethinking.com mm-hmm. on our blog, you'll see a lot of good pieces there that really kind of put our point of view out there and help companies think in the right way so they can innovate successfully. And that is bringing in, people. So
if I reach out to you, it's not because I heard about you. It's because I've been hearing about you and I've been tapping into your thought leadership. And maybe from there, it's backed up with a reputation. All those things kind of play together, huh?
Yeah, the products we do are pretty big. I mean, it's a pretty significant investment. So the sales cycle, because of that, tends to be pretty long. So before most people contact you, they've been on your website, they've done their homework, they've read your case studies, read your thought leadership, and then they
listen to
out.
Your Business Radio X interview. Exactly. The whole thing, right?
Now, are you?
Yeah, always listen to your Business Radio X interview. Always.
Are you speaking at conferences, and do you go to trade shows? Is that part of the?
Yep. That's all kind of push. So conferences are great. You know, you have a captive audience who are paid to be there and want to hear what you have to say. Typically, so that's a great way to create interesting.
What topics do you talk on?
Recently, just last week, my partner Trent, he was talking at the Human Factors Conference on healthcare. So how to do research at the fuzzy front end to understand, you know, behaviors of surgeons and patients and how to track that and make those insights actionable for product development in the healthcare space, for example.
And then a good client for you is one that believes that design is a competitive advantage?
Yeah, I think an organization has to have a culture that believes in design. And to me, design's a strategic business tool. Design's having a very good it's having a very good moment right now, so to speak. You know, because lots of organizations are like, I'd say in some ways, business is stuck. You know, we've tried all these things. We've eked out all the efficiencies on an operations side. You know, we can be more profitable that way. But how are we different? How do we stand out? And design's a very good tool for that.
Right.
And
I don't think we're leveraging the technology. We're doing it. I think we're at almost, I don't want to say toddler stage in that area. It's just more clumsy and less elegant than I think it can be and should be.
And I think design's always been a strategic business tool, but people haven't seen it like that. They've often seen it as a very visual type of icing on the cake for a product or a service. We'll make it look good. We'll make it look nice and all those types of things. It's way deeper than that. It's how people interact with your service and your product.
Right.
You know, it takes your brand's purpose, your brand's values, and it brings those to life in three dimensions. And it makes your brand real. And if it's done well and your products are easy to use and, you know, people find them fulfilling to use, then you're ahead of the competition.
Right.
And I think just recently we've had a few good cases that have come out that show the value of design. And design historically has struggled with this because it can be very subjective. You know, you like a red car, I like a blue car, you like a green car. Why? You know, which one's better than the other? But there's a great organization called the Design Management Institute, and they developed this design index. So what they did, they tracked 16 publicly traded companies who invested in design. So Apple, Coca-Cola, Ford, Herman Miller, IBM, people like that. And they tracked them against the S&P 500.
Are there stock prices?
Yeah. And they did this over a period of 5 to 10 years. And what they saw is that those companies who invested in design outperformed the other ones by 211%.
Wow. How about that?
So you just when you do your sales pitch, you just throw that out.
That's
there.
Right.
Just,
yeah, but
ROI, here you go.
This is all very recent stuff for the design industry. And just last week, McKinsey came out with a brand new study on the business value of design.
Do you like the design of that cover? It looks a little busy.
No, he doesn't. But he likes the report.
I'm pulling the face here. Great report, though. So they're kind of claiming, I think they're right, this is the most extensive and rigorous piece of research undertaken. And over a five-year period, they tracked 300 publicly traded companies. They recorded over 100,000 design actions. They had 2 million pieces of data. And they found that companies that invested in design outperformed other companies by 10%. You know,
nice.
So
there is an ROI to design.
Yeah, and this is the first time we've had those kind of stories
important.
And metrics. No. It's always been a very subjective struggle. So
now it's more objective.
So I think design's really becoming of age, and these companies are seeing it as a strategic business tool, and
thrives right in the middle of it.
Yeah, we're flying the flag and making progress on that front.
So now, if somebody wanted to learn more, where can they go?
You can go to thrivethinking.com. That's our website. There's all sorts of stuff on there, case studies, our services, and a great blog.
Well, thanks so much for coming and sharing your story. And keep up the good work, man. This is fantastic.
We will.
Must be a lot of fun, rewarding work.
It's different every day, yeah.
Well, and don't be a stranger. I'm operating under the impression you probably have some local clients. It might be fun sometime, Lee, like if... I don't know what the editorial calendar looks like, but wouldn't it be cool to do like a design episode or a design segment, maybe come in with a client and talk about how you work together or something?
We could certainly do that. That would
be
great.
That could be fun.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Right. Hey, stay with us. Maybe we got one more guest we're going to visit with.
We'll do. Thank you.
All right, Lee, you ready for the headliner?
I am.
All right. There is a new media property very close to being born. Is that the right?
That's it. It's a... She's getting ready to launch.
We are in crouch position, pre-launcher mode. It's going to be called, I believe, working title anyway, Sincerely Sanj. Please join me in welcoming to the program Sanjay. And I'm not going to share her last name with you because I don't know how to pronounce it properly. But welcome to the show.
Hello. How are you guys doing this morning?
We're doing well. How do you pronounce your last name?
So it's Teray.
Teray.
So there's actually an accent on the E, so it's kind of French.
Teray. I like it. Well, no, you know, my name is Stone, and I have an affinity for art. I don't have any talent, but I thought maybe if I went and worked in the abstract area that I could create Stone A's. So I'm right there with you, babe. All right. So please welcome to the program, Sanjay Teray.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
Well, Sanjay, you recently graduated college.
I did.
And moved here to Atlanta.
I did.
And tell us what you're up to.
So I graduated in May. I went to a small school in Milton, Massachusetts. It's actually a private college, and I studied broadcast communications. I dabbled in everything broadcast media. So I did my school's online newspaper. I did television production. I did radio. Actually, I had my own radio show for a little bit. Yeah. So moving here, I knew that as a minority, there's just way more opportunities here for me. So that's what I'm up to. I'm looking for a job here. I'm trying to get into TV broadcast.
And then part of this is launching this. Is it going to be a YouTube show?
Yes, definitely.
And it's called Sincerely Sanj. Mm-hmm. And what are some of the things you're going to be covering?
So I would just like to interview local talents. I would like to go to openings and just really showcase Atlanta, I guess. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and from my perspective.
And then what has been your perspective coming from the north to the south? Any big differences?
Were you expecting all overalls?
More pickup trucks?
Pickup trucks?
So the accents are really strong, I'll tell you that. Really strong.
I know, I can still hear your accent.
That's it.
Yeah. Right. So the weather is amazing. The southern hospitality is actually a real thing because New England, we definitely don't have that. And I feel like it's just very, really business oriented down here. I feel like there's just a lot of things going on and people trying to, you know, aspire to do things. There's just a lot going on, I feel.
So now, what kind of age were you at when you're like, you know what, I want to get into broadcasting or broadcast media?
So my dad is a big news guy, and he was always watching the news, like Al Jazeera, CNN.
Was he on the news, or he was a watcher?
A big watcher.
He's a fan of the news.
He's a fan. So he likes like a lot of international news, and I was just always like watching it with him, and I just admire commentators and newscasters and just people who are able to articulate themselves well. So I was just always wanting to be in that position.
So you wanted to be the, like an anchor person that's reading the news, or did you want to be out into the field doing, you know, right in the midst of the action?
So for the longest amount of time, I wanted to be in the anchor chair, sitting in just like the person that you see in the morning and the person that you see before you go to bed. But after going to college and seeing what goes on behind the scenes and everything, and not to dub or to downplay what anchors do, but they just read off of teleprompters and they're in the station all the time. And I feel like that's not something I would ideally want to do. I'm someone who would like to go out and get my story, investigate and speak to people on the road. So now I'm leaning more towards broadcast reporting.
And that's where the Sincerely Sanj will let you go out into the field and kind of do that.
Right.
And meet the people and talk to them and help kind of support and celebrate their work.
Yep.
I like the vision. I don't have the work ethic or the IQ points to pull it off, but let's contrast. I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed what we just did a little while ago when we interviewed Jonathan Dalton with Thrive. And I think there's plenty of value for that. And obviously we're going to continue to try to do that for the market and envision Sanjay out at Thrive, following Jonathan around, asking these questions, and then maybe asking other people on site questions. Maybe they've got a client in, asking them some questions before they go in, asking them some questions when they come out. I mean, that's a different, and I would think if it's produced properly,
right,
a very rich piece of content
right,
that would be incredibly valuable for those of us out in the world that, you know, need to tap into ideas like Ideas Start With Insight. But also imagine the marketing utility for somebody like a Jonathan Dalton and those guys.
Right. That skill, I think, transfers to a lot of different industries outside of just broadcast media.
I agree. I mean, I think you could tap into the whole core. I mean, we're kind of one trick ponies here, right? So our lens is how can we help people and make money with radio and media? So, you know, you may want to do more philanthropic stuff or you might want to go do giraffes. But if I had your work ethic and talent and drive,
thank you,
I'd want to go to Jonathan's office and do what you're describing, I think.
That sounds amazing to me. If Jonathan's up for that.
Absolutely.
Well, now in school, did you learn just you were on camera? Did you also learn the behind the scenes and some of the production stuff as well? So you're
I did.
So you can do the whole thing.
The soup whole to thing. That. So because I was so passionate about getting into broadcast reporting, I felt that it was necessary to know what's going on behind the scenes. So I took a lot of post-production courses and just television production in general.
And that's like editing and things
filming,
like that.
Filming, script writing.
Oh, so you were doing every aspect
everything.
Of it.
Wow. So we have this thing called one man band in television. So basically it's someone who goes out and they film and they edit and they do everything on their own.
Oh, so that's a role in broadcasting?
Yeah.
Is one man? I never heard that.
One man band.
So yeah. There's equipment and there's all the stuff that's meant to be mobile and carried by one person.
Right, definitely. So like my camera, you guys can't see it, but definitely it flips up so I can see everything that I'm recording. So there's a lot of things that, you know, helps with the one man band.
Right. Yeah. To help you just efficiently do it.
Right.
Now for you, how are you kind of setting yourself apart from the other? I would imagine this is a popular major. A lot of people come out of college wanting to do what you're doing, and there's not that many slots to do that in broadcast media.
Yeah. So I feel like my generation, we're not so aware of a lot of things that are happening in society, and we get a lot of our information from social media, which it's not a bad thing, but I feel like we should have a reliable source. And I feel like what I want to do is be able to gather information for people of my generation and younger to really, you know, understand what's happening in society and really grasp what's going on. And I feel like that's what I want to do. I want to set myself aside or set myself apart by doing things differently and being relatable to my generation. And I feel like so many people who are doing broadcast reporting, we're all using a certain jargon. We're using things that only a certain demographic will understand. And not a lot of people can understand that, especially in my generation. So I want to do things differently that'll make it relatable to people of my age. So I think that's how I'll set myself apart.
And then so far in your journey here, your dream job is what? To be like CNN or one of the big?
Definitely. I would love to work for a big company like that. And I actually have a little story. In college, I had a radio show, as I said, and I had a guest come in. His name was Adam, and he had his own clothing line, and they had varsity jackets. And on the back of each varsity jacket, it was like a serial number, and the serial number represented all of the women that were being sex trafficked in America.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was like a really important and just deep meaning behind it all. And he got the whole inspiration from his girlfriend. And she was someone who was like a public speaker, and she goes around to a lot of universities. She speaks about just women empowerment and sex trafficking and stuff of that sort. And I say all of this just to say that I followed her after our interview, and I just started to see what she was doing. And now she's just doing amazingly. And she works for Newsy, and she has her own docuseries. And she goes to a lot of local cities, and she speaks to women who are in the sex trafficking business. And she just gets like the story of what's going on and like the nitty gritty. And I feel like that's something I would want to do. I don't want to just, as I said, be in a station all the time and just doing one thing. I want to get out there and hear stories of people who aren't really represented in, you know, media.
Now, for you, if somebody wanted to learn more, do you have a website yet for this venture?
I'm working on it, but I definitely do have YouTube. Yeah.
So on YouTube, they would find you how?
Sincerely Sanj.
And then you're on LinkedIn and you're on all the
other social media. Twitter, Instagram, it's all Sincerely
Sanj. Either Sanjay Torre or Sincerely Sanj will find you.
definitely.
Well, you asked her how she's setting herself apart. I'll tell you one way she's setting herself apart. While she has all these aspirations of working with these companies and doing all this cool stuff, she's not sitting around waiting to be chosen. She's getting out there and doing something and building out her portfolio and providing value. You don't know what kind of opportunity she's going to trip over, right? Doing that.
That's right.
That's fantastic. Congratulations.
Thank you guys so much.
Good stuff. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. This is Lee Cantor for Stone Payton. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.